Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, 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 and welcome, ladybirds and gentle lemurs, to the Human Nature Podcast. Here we explore the ups and downs of being Homo sapiens and learn a thing or two on how to be a better animal. My name is Elliot Connor, and I'm at least half elephant. But the star of the show today is none other than Niels Bouillard, who is a Belgian ecologist and, dare I say, a consultant superstar, a naturalist who has logged many, many thousands of observations across all sorts of species, but I hear with a special interest in those with flight. So, Niels, welcome to the show.
Hi, Elliot. Thank you.
So, I hear you've chosen to speak about bats with us today. What led you to that choice, and why this fascination with these creatures of the air?
As many people, when I was a kid, I liked animals. And then when I wanted to get seriously into it, I got into birding. And that led me to meet lots of people. And then one day I ended up catching bats with some of my friends as part of a larger project. It was a serious thing. And I just loved it. And then what I really liked is that the more I read about them, the more I understood that we know basically nothing about them. And it's something that really drew me to them, because with birds, when I had a question, I could find the answer, and I don't like finding answers. Yeah. I like finding more questions. And I had that with bats. So yeah, that's what I've been doing for years now, is just asking myself questions, looking up answers, and ending up with more questions than I had in the beginning.
Awesome. Now, I love that answer, that desire to know more, have more questions instead of just finding the answers. I think it's a beautiful thing. Now, I do some bird banding here in Australia, so for research, of course. But I think it'd be really interesting for our audience if you can go through just how you go about researching bats. You mentioned catching them. I assume you're taking some measurements, perhaps logging their size, their movements. How does that all come together? And for yourself and your work, how do you record the biodiversity of the bats that may be present in an area?
Yeah, so I didn't find bats is extremely difficult. that's the first thing to know. And also, in most countries where research is being done, they're protected, so you have to go through the whole process of designing a project to then apply for a license and stuff like that. But legal aspects aside, the main issue when you want to research diversity of bats is making sure that the method you're using allows you to identify the species you're looking for. Yeah. So with catching, you can basically identify everything, although now with all the genetics work that's being done, it's getting harder and harder to identify the species, because you need to put them in a little Eppendorf and then run some PCR tests. Anyway, so the main method is catching them, exactly like you do with birds to band them. So you set up nets. They're slightly different nets, but the idea is the same. And you catch them, and then there are a few measurements that you can take. The main one is the forearm. It would be the equivalent of wing length on a bird. You can also measure some of the fingers, because bats have five fingers, just like us. And I know that various people in various parts of the world measure different fingers. I've asked why everyone was measuring that finger, not that one. And yeah, I never really got a definitive answer, but people measure any finger they want, basically. And then sometimes you have to measure specific things just to get to an identification. And that could be the fingernail of one of the fingers, can be the phalanx of one of a thumb. It can be extremely crazy things to measure and that are insanely small. And that make you rethink everything you've done this far. But then there's also methods that are relatively new, and that's all the acoustics side of things. That's the bit I really love. It has a lot of challenges, but the main cool thing about it is that it's non-invasive. So you don't have to catch the bats. And that means it can be done in most places without needing a license or anything like that. So you could do a preliminary survey with acoustics being like, oh, this is good because it's got a lot of diversity. Even if you don't get all the identifications right because of acoustics, you can still have a pretty good idea of the level of diversity of a given site. And then if you want, you can, you know, build a project and apply for a license and then catch. But it also allows you to cover a lot more ground than catching, because catching is extremely time intensive. So yeah, there's those two big methods. They each have their benefits and drawbacks, obviously. I love them both. Yeah. Oh yeah, you also have roost visits. So there can be summer roost visits or winter roost visits. I only do the latter. And you basically just check caves of hibernating bats, at least in Europe. And then you identify them there. And it's actually the main method used for population estimates in some parts of Europe, because it's the only time in the year where you're pretty sure that you are seeing a significant part of the population, because you can't draw any sort of population statistics from acoustics.
Yeah.
And then traveling, I mean, you do catch some bat, but you don't know how that relates to the population as a whole. Whereas sure. If you survey most caves in your country, you're getting close.
Now, I've got very vivid memories of a bat count I did last year. So we've got the flying foxes here in Sydney, very cool bats to have.
Yeah.
somewhat of a nuisance. They get a bit of a bad rap, but very interesting bats, which we have in many of the local parks. I was doing it as part of a citizen science project in a local park. And what they do is they have a post of several volunteers at maybe 15 degree intervals all around the swamp area where the bats were roosting during the day. Arrive there just as it's getting dark, dusk, and wait till they start to fly out. Initially it's a trickle of them leaving their roosting sites, going out to feed as the night gets darker. But then it turns into this continuous stream. And because, of course, bats, when they fly, they're not particularly consistent, or they don't always fly in straight lines. So especially at the start, you have some which just circle back. So you're trying to count those which are going out and those which are going back. It's an absolute nightmare. So you're trying to get it to the closest order of magnitude, essentially. I can't imagine. It's especially scientific doing it that way. But it was highly amusing, nevertheless.
Yeah. I mean, there are caves in Texas, for example, that have millions or sometimes dozens of millions of bats. So if you want to count those, obviously you can't count the whole thing. So you have to count a time window. But then it's hard to make sure that that window is actually really representative of the whole, because it's not a constant flow. So it's really tricky.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I was reading a bit more about the work that you do, some of the fascinating things you've been up to. And one project, which of course is especially notable, is this big bat year you took. Traveling around the world, trying to see as many species of these creatures as you could. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, I started as a birder, and obviously the big years that were done in 2015 and 2016 were, I mean, I followed them and I was really excited by them. And then I saw the amount of attention it was getting, and the fact that it could be used, that attention could be used to raise awareness on conservation issues that most people don't know about. So I figured, why not do the same for bats? Because whatever number I get, it's a world record, so that's good. And then also, it's never been done before, and it would be a good way to draw attention to those creatures from a different perspective. Because my goal was really, by using a format that's well known to birders, my goal was to basically make birders love bats more. That was one of the goals. I ended up seeing and recording 396 bat species, which is actually pretty good. I had no idea what kind of numbers I could expect because, well, no one's done that before. Very few people travel to see bats. It's not really a hobby. It's more of either a job or, that's it. It's really mostly professionals who work with bats. There aren't too many hobbyists. But I think that's something that's lacking because once you get hobbyists into something, that means there's money in it. And that means you can fund ecotourism, which is a big thing in a lot of tropical regions where you have all those birding lodges and things because birders bring in money. And if bats become a hobby, they could also become a source of income, and then they would be protected the same way birds are protected in some areas.
I think that's really interesting. Do you have an idea of why bird watching may be so popular and perhaps bat watching hasn't yet taken on?
Well, I think it's a lot of different things. First is, bats are an obscure creature that a lot of people are afraid of because, you know, when you're a kid, you hear stories about them. And then also, they're not really colourful. I mean, if you look at birds, you've got basically every colour on there.
Yeah.
Bats, there are a few that are colourful, but there's like maybe a dozen from around the world. So they're not as attractive visually, I want to say. And also is that if you want to watch birds, obviously having binoculars helps a lot. But even if you don't have them, you can still see things. With bats... Yeah. Unless you have flying foxes nearby, because they are a big exception, I would say. And there may be some caves that you might know. But if you want to get into acoustics, the entry price is usually quite high. And the required skills are immediately very high as well. You don't really have time to get through that learning curve. It gets really complicated really fast. Yeah, it's a combination of being expensive, being very complex. And also, the bat reputation. But I think it can change, and it is changing in a lot of places around the world,
No, I certainly hope that we can get more bat watchers into the future. It sounds fascinating what you've been up to. Of course, here in Sydney with the flying foxes, we just get them flapping across the horizon with the setting sun. It's a beautiful sight. But sadly, not the case where you are or in 99% of the world. So... much, much harder to see them, to appreciate them, I would imagine. You mentioned just then around the reputation that bats have acquired. I'm really interested to hear perhaps some of your perspective on, in your travels, have you encountered that? What do you think the origin perhaps of some of those beliefs, superstitions may be? And some of this ongoing fear surrounding bats and these creatures of the night.
So what I noticed, and I mean, it might just be my feeling, but when talking to other people, it looks like there's something in there, is that so you've got different categories of how people think about bats. So the main one, the one we know, is the people fear bats. And that seems to be mainly centered around Europe and its former colonies. So where there's still a European influence, and that would include North America and Australia. Once you leave that sort of sphere of influence, you find that people either don't care about bats, they're just an animal like any other. They can be a nuisance if they eat the crops, for example, or they can be a source of food like any other animal in the forest. You've got those three different perspectives, and often you find that they coexist. So unless people have a direct relationship with the bats, either because they need them to eat or because, well, they don't like because they eat the food they need, they don't really care. So yeah, that fear of bats that I'm very used to here in Europe, I didn't really find it elsewhere. It was quite surprising, but then when I think about it, it's understandable, because we tend to be fairly disconnected from nature, whereas most people around the world aren't that disconnected.
Okay. Now, that's something I'd never considered. So really interesting to hear some of that geographical divide in terms of how we look at bats and creatures like that. I think it's a really good point you raise. I imagine we've got time for maybe one more question. It's probably one you get asked quite often. But do you have a favourite species of bat or any animal indeed?
No, I don't. I've got a selection. So based on specific criteria, I will have bat or... Yeah, I had to work on my answer because I can't just answer, I don't know, because that's just so underwhelming. So in Europe, for example, my favourite bat would be the particulate bat, which is a bat that not only looks really pretty when you see it up close. I've never seen it, but I've seen lots of pictures, and I'm looking at a sticker that I've put on my laptop right now. I really like that bat. And also it's a migratory bat, so it does over 3,000 kilometers a year, which is quite impressive for a bat that's 15 grams.
Yeah.
And then further afield, I mean, obviously, yeah, the fairly colorful ones, so the yellow-winged bat from East Africa, the painted bat from Southeast Asia, which is bright orange and black. That's a surprisingly good camouflage when you roost it, in a dead banana leaf. I was not expecting that, but after having seen one under a dead banana leaf, it doesn't look that bright and orange, so yeah. And then, I mean, a lot of bats are really cool, but yeah, it's hard to pick one, really. Then there are bats, obviously, that I had a great time with during my bat year, so I'm a bit biased there, but I rediscovered a critically endangered species in New Caledonia.
Wow.
It's nothing special. I mean, yeah, the discovery is special, but the bat itself is nothing special. It's one of those long ears that you get in Australia. It's just another one of those. But the fact that it was presumed extinct and then I found it is exciting to me. So I really like that bat as well.
Definitely. Now, I love the answer as a bird watcher and being a naturalist myself. It's something you have to find an answer to. What's your favourite bird? What's your favourite bat? It's not an easy question by any means.
Yeah, because you get the question all the time and then you're like, well, I don't really know because there's so many. I mean,
of course. Yeah. No, but I love that breakdown of yours. It's a fascinating species you mentioned. Incredible as well, your story about New Caledonia, rediscovering the bat. Very, very impressive.
I also found a completely new bat for science in West Papua.
Okay.
It hasn't been described yet because that's super tricky getting permits and things. But we know it's new and that's about it.
Okay. No, really interesting. Yeah, I think that's definitely... one of those bucket list goals you must have as a scientist, a naturalist, researcher, discovering a new species.
Yeah, it was when I was 7 or 8 and people used to ask me, what's your dream in life? That would be my answer, discovering a new species. So, yeah, I was a bit of an oddball as a kid, but I've done it. So that's it.
Love it. Love it. Well, it's been great chatting, Nils. It's been a fascinating conversation. Of course, for our listeners, we'll be back next week with another episode of the Human Nature Podcast. Until then, stay safe and do try and be a better animal. Thank you all and goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.